I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Ophebia Quist-Arten, NPR's West Africa correspondent, stops by Tell Me More's D.C. studios to give us an update on the stories she's been covering. But first, President Barack Obama is in China. He met today with Chinese President Hu Jintao, and earlier he held a town hall meeting with students in Shanghai. There he faced a question that might not have been posed to his predecessors. One student asked him if America, as a diverse country, would help build a diverse world. Here is President Obama's reply.
We do not seek to impose any system of government on any other nation. But we also don't believe that the principles that we stand for are unique to our nation. These freedoms of expression and worship, of access to information and political participation, we believe are universal rights. They should be available to all people, including ethnic and religious minorities, whether they are in the United States, China, or any nation.
Diversity in China is a tricky subject, as it is in many countries. There are more than 50 ethnic minorities in China and much debate over how to integrate them with the majority Han Chinese. Obama was also in Japan on this trip, another place with complex racial attitudes. We wanted to know more, so we called Anthony Kuhn, NPR's correspondent in Beijing. And from Boston, we are joined by Philip Martin. He oversees the Color Initiative, which is a series of reports that airs on Public Radio International's The World. He has spent a lot of time in Japan, and he's reported extensively on the subject of ethnic minorities and racial attitudes in Asia. I welcome you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle. Good to be here.
Anthony, I want to start with you. Now, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made a comment last week that I think many Americans found shocking. Will you tell us what he said?
Yes, this was last Thursday at a routine meeting briefing for foreign correspondents by the foreign ministry. And the spokesperson said that because President Obama was a black man, then he should understand that the Communist Party had liberated the serfs by liberating Tibet in 1959. And what he was trying to say, I think, was that Tibet had a slavery problem, and that they had an emancipator in the Communist Party, and that at the time, you know, President Lincoln was trying to keep the Union together as China is now. But it didn't come out well. I don't think it was a message that was crafted for a foreign audience. And what it sounded like to a lot of foreign observers was that they were saying because President Obama is a black president, he should see China's Tibet policy is the way Chinese people do. It just didn't go over well overseas.
How does China, is there a sort of a national philosophy about race and ethnicity in China, or is there the official view that minorities are all treated the same, or what is the kind of the national view on this, and how does, is there a variance with how it's experienced by minorities in China?
Well, you have to understand, Michelle, that, you know, China is one of the most ancient civilizations in the world, going back thousands of years, and it has always been a multi-ethnic state and a lot of the time an empire. But the concept of race and nationality are very different from what we know in from modern concepts. Basically, the traditional view was that a nation was the same as a race, and that the Han race was the same as the Chinese nation. And China has made a lot of progress away from that. They realized that all the Mongolians and the Tibetans and the Manchus and the Miao and all these 56 different ethnic groups, including the Han, are equally Chinese. But still, there are problems when people who are not Han Chinese are thought of as foreigners. And of course, this issue has blown up in the past 2 years with riots in Tibet last year in March, and this year in China's far west in Xinjiang province in Central Asia. Hmm. And so although the government doesn't admit these are ethnic issues, it says these are just about separatism and terrorism, it really is about how well the country has done giving these people the autonomy they need, the opportunities they need to enter the mainstream. Although the government doesn't like to admit it, there is a very strong debate going on here.
I want to hear more about that in a minute, but I want to bring Philip into the conversation. Philip, how is, you know, I think most Americans are used to thinking of Japan as a mono-ethnic country. Is it really that way?
Well, I think that that's how Asia is thought of, East Asia is thought of in general. And no, it's not. I think that in Japan you find a minorities that are in many ways acknowledged as minorities. They're both ethnic minorities and they're class minorities. A class minority, for example, would be the Burakamin, descendants of leather workers who largely live in the south of the country, including Osaka. And then you also have an indigenous group called the Ainu, a very tiny, tiny group, I think represented by only one person in the Diet, if I'm not mistaken. And you, of course, also have people who've lived in Japan for many, many years, decades, some centuries, including Chinese and Koreans, those we now know as Chinese and Koreans. And so they occupy a very important part in Japanese society. But many of the Koreans and Japanese will complain, and it's been determined objectively, that they face discrimination. At one point, I interviewed a young man who, for example, wanted to be a pilot. He's of Korean descent, and he said that he had the hardest time achieving that goal because of traditional prejudices in Japanese society.
You mean getting access to the education he would need to take on that profession, or what?
Not so much access to education, but in terms of contacts. Japan, of course, is built on among other things, among contacts, family, who you know, and how Japanese you actually are in terms of perception.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Anthony Kuhn of NPR and Philip Martin of PRI, and we're talking about race and ethnicity in Asia. Anthony, will you tell us a story that, as I understand it, got a lot of attention in China recently about a young woman singer where there have been a couple of biracial public figures whose treatment by the public has kind of brought the racial dialogue, at least in regard to non-white, non-Asians, into the open. Will you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's right, Michelle. There's two people. One of them is a young athlete named Ding Hui who made the national volleyball team. And he is part African-American and part, he's part Chinese and part black. The other woman was a contestant on a song contest on TV, and her father was African-American and her mother was Chinese. And both of these characters have been subject to a very intense debate in the media in China. In the case of the athlete, a lot of remarks were made about his white teeth. In the young woman in Shanghai, there's a lot of comments about her sense of rhythm having to do with her ethnicity. And also, in the woman's case, a lot of people were critical because of what they said was the fact that her mother was not faithful, and this young woman was born out of wedlock. But it's attracted a lot of attention inside and outside China to questions of multi-ethnic families. And really, this is a novelty, in a sense, for China. There haven't been that many of this kind of marriages in China, and a lot of people don't know what to make of it. They're not sure what ethnicity these people are. And just for example, China is a country that still does not recognize, for example, dual nationality. They consider you either you're one or the other. Mm. And so it's partly the same question with race. Chinese public is still trying to deal with it.
Well, in, I think Louisa Lim, our colleague Louisa Lim's reporting, it was actually not just perplexed that they were actually, there were some people who were just outright ugly to her and just made nasty comments about her complexion and suggested she shouldn't be in public and so forth. I mean, so do you feel that kind of attitude is widespread?
Yes. Let me make another, take another couple of examples. One is former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who unfortunately was subject to some very derogatory remarks on previous visits. Also, there's a fairly large contingent of African students studying in China. And in 1989, in the southern city of Nanjing, there were some civil disturbances, some near riots over issues related to these students. And I might add that just in general, as an aesthetic sort of thing, Chinese believe that lighter skin color is more attractive, and women there spend money on skin whiteners and things to shield them from the sun. It's considered, the fairer the skin you have, the more attractive you are. And this is something which is very sensitive now in relation to these racial issues, but is a fact. It's obvious just riding on the street, riding a bicycle on the street. You can see people shielding themselves from the sun because they don't want to get tanned.
Can I add, Philip? Sure. We only have about a minute left, so I do want to ask in the minute we have left if you would mm-hmm. comment on whether you think the fact of an African American being president of the United States will have an impact on these attitudes around the world, in the part of the world that you've been covering.
I think it will have some impact, but I think when we talk about China, we have to realize that Obama does not have the same star status in China as he does in other places, and that even as he was on the rise, he was the subject of very, very, if you will, nasty remarks on the Internet. The Internet is, as Anthony will probably agree, is the place where a lot of opinions come together, where they can't be said in other places. Thus, the hostile reaction to Lu Jing, the young woman in Shanghai, and to Obama to some degree. I think that he will have some impact, but I don't think that will ameliorate deeply ingrained prejudices that are reinforced by homogeneity and a veneration of whiteness.
We're going to have to leave it there for now. It's a very complex and interesting subject. I thank you both. That was Philip Martin. He heads the Color Initiative at Public Radio International's The World. He joined us from Boston. And NPR foreign correspondent Anthony Kuhn joined us from our bureau in Beijing. Gentlemen, I thank you both.
Thank you,
Michelle.
Appreciate it.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we hear about one courageous young journalist and her fight to give a voice to the tens of thousands of victims of the long war in the Congo. But first, from time to time, we like to catch up with NPR's foreign correspondents to talk about what they're doing and how they're doing. Ophebia Quist-Arkton has spent the last year covering some of Africa's most complex and challenging stories, from Guinea to Senegal, from Nigeria to Ghana. And we're pleased to have her with us in our studios to check in and share some of the highlights of her last year. Ophebia, welcome. Welcome back. It's good to see you.
Lovely to be back here. Has it been a year already?
Yes, it has. Now, I hate to start on such a disturbing note, but when we last heard from you last month, you had just traveled to Guinea in West Africa. On September 28th, more than 50,000 people had gathered at an opposition rally in the capital of Conakry when presidential guards opened fire on the crowds, killing more than 150 people, according to human rights groups. Now, the government says 57 were killed, but even more shocking than the shootings, as you reported, were the rapes of scores of women in broad daylight. And you were saying that these rapes had shaken the country. You spoke with some of the survivors in Guinea. I just want to play a short clip of what one of them told you.
I don't want to give my name in the radio because they know us all. I am a teacher. I am in that place where they do us rough. And I saw the poor soldier men beat the policemen, beat the women, tear their clothes and their trousers, took a knife and dug it in the women. Even I, they do it. I'm so afraid.
And of course, you found out this woman was actually talking about herself.
You know, what I hadn't realized when I was with the women was that they weren't all survivors of rape. Some of them had witnessed all sorts of atrocities in the stadium. And Guinea is a Muslim country. It is very conservative, Michelle. So, of course, this woman, although they were all women and were all going to be sympathetic, didn't want other women to know she had been raped. So it was the guidance counselor who said to me afterwards, all those things she was telling you, that happened to her. That was, you know, I felt so bad. So after that, I kept, you know, I made reasons for why other women should walk out. And I said, I need quiet to record and so on.
Do you have any sense of how this started and why this started? And is there any history of this behavior in Guinea? We're going to hear in a couple of minutes from another journalist working in the Congo who's been documenting the stories of women and girls, some 200,000 women and girls in the eastern region of Congo who we believe have been brutalized in the war there since 1998, but in Guinea.
Security forces firing on civilians, yes. Rape of women, yes, but not in broad daylight on a Monday morning at noon, Michelle. And a lot of people were saying to me in Guinea, said, "You've jamais vu." In French, that means we have never witnessed this before. And they're saying, you know, a lot of women, a lot of people are saying it's the security forces making the capital Conakry into almost a combat zone, a conflict zone, to try and control women and to silence them. So it's the same sort of phenomenon that we've been seeing in Eastern Congo over recent years.
Is there any sign that the perpetrators will be held accountable? I mean, Guinea's military leader is indeed the commander-in-chief of these forces. He's the leader of the country. Is there any sign that any accountability is being demanded?
There's a lot of pressure, Michelle. There's a lot of pressure from within Guinea, from within West Africa, from within the African Union. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said there must be no impunity this time, and that Captain Moussa Dadis Camara must step down. He's the military leader, that the other junta leaders must also be held to account, and the soldiers, and especially the women in Guinea, are saying, pas d'impunité cette fois-ci. No impunity this time. We want justice.
Moving now to a different topic, President Obama visited Ghana in July. This was his first official trip to sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, with his African roots, his Kenyan father, there was some excitement over his visit. Let's listen to a song that was written in his honor.
President Barack Obama, welcome to Ghana. His Excellency, President Atanos, and the Ghana Bravo.
Now, you traveled to Accra for his visit. What was the reaction?
Ha-ha, you know, it was coming to my home, so it was most exciting. It was especially exciting, I think, for Ghanaians to welcome the whole of the Obama family, because a lot of people say Michelle Obama comes from the Fanti Coast. She feels that she does, they say, and it was lovely to welcome the children as well. And I think Ghanaians felt it was a real privilege. It was the US and Washington saying, yes, Ghana, you're on the right track.
What about the rest of the continent? Did the visit register there?
Oh, yes.
Elsewhere?
All over. Although Ghana was the chosen country that President Obama visited, I think a lot of Africans all over the continent felt Ghanaian that way, because they felt that, this is the first black African-American president, and he has chosen to come to Africa.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with NPR's West Africa correspondent, Ophibia Quist-Darkin. We're taking a peek into her reporter's notebook, and we're talking about some of the news highlights that she's reported on over the past year. I think one of the highlights for many of our listeners will be the series that you did in August on emerging cultural voices from Africa. You profiled different artists throughout the continent. The first you spoke with is Lebo
Mashile.
Okay, here you go.
Yeah.
Let's play just a short clip. She represents the Born Frees, the young generation of post-apartheid South Africa. Here she is performing The Ancient Ones. Here it is.
The Ancient Ones plait their stories into the futures of their children. The Ancient Ones, they use their hands to heal the backs of broken men. And I hold a pen for every ancient who dared not hold a fist against the tyranny that sucked the life and hope out of her breasts.
Exciting.
Isn't she?
Yeah.
30 years old, Michelle. She is not only a poet and a writer. She presents radio shows. She hosts television shows. She is, you know, the promise of South Africa for me, this young woman, Lebo Mashile. And she's not the only one. There are a lot of them. But she's also a really thinking, deep young woman, saying that we are the product of what our parents, our aunts, our uncles, the older generations, they fought for. They struggled. So we mustn't just take post-apartheid South Africa freedom, liberation for granted. Marvelous.
Is spoken word very popular in South Africa?
Becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah.
Another emerging voice you highlighted is the rapper Didier Awadi from Senegal. And here is Awadi performing. Let's play a short clip.
Our music is for us a weapon of mass education to fight all the injustice that we face everywhere, every day. It's high time for us to rebuild our soul. So that's why we say positive black soul, show another image of Africa, to force everybody not to look at us with pity, and all Africans must be proud of what we are. We have good reason to be proud of Africa.
Hey, hey, And what language does he perform in?
He speaks Wolof, French, English, you name it. The young people in Africa these days are absolute polyglots. They speak every language. But as you hear, he is very, very, very proficient in English. What I really liked about Awadi, apart from being a rapper and a musician, he talks to a lot of very young people. He says to young Africans, young Senegalese, don't get on rickety boats and try and get to Europe and North America. Try and build, rebuild your own countries. We are the ones. We are the next generation. If we disappear, what is going to happen to our countries?
And he's not tempted himself. I mean, one of the people who are often sort of the ambassadors for a country are the cultural workers, the artists, musicians. They're often the first ones to leave.
Absolutely not. He is rooted in Senegal, travels a hell of a lot all over the continent, all over the world, and, you know, rapping, bringing the message and so on. But he says he's going nowhere. Senegal is his country.
And finally, one more fascinating story from Senegal that you brought us involved a board game that hopes to encourage the creation of the United States of Africa. Tell us about it.
The inventor is called Salif Tijamba. And what he says he wants through this game is to teach young African people, African school children, and those who are interested in Africa, that it's only together that the continent is going to move forward. So it's a bit of a complicated game, Michelle, but it has questions, and it also has sages, the wise leaders of Africa. Now, you'd think those would be who? Nelson Mandela, founding father of African Pan-Africanism, Kwame Nkrumah and so on. But he also has people like Muammar Gaddafi and, you know, a controversial leader, the leader of Libya. We asked him, well, why? And he said, well, anyone who is fighting for Africa to be united can be considered a sage.
So maybe I'll put it on my Christmas list.
Try. It's coming out in English soon.
Well, it's always good to see you, Afebia. Thank you for stopping by. Any plans you can share with us for the next few months, what you're going to be looking at?
The continent, as usual. I think immediately the climate change conference in Copenhagen, an African angle. And then we shall see, as always, all over Africa.
Afebia Christ-Octon is NPR's West Africa correspondent. She was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Afebia, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Now we go to Congo, where we're going to talk more about a subject we touched on earlier with Afebia, the way women and girls are being increasingly targeted by combatants on both sides of a conflict. This is especially true in the Congo, where for the past decade, the Democratic Republic of Congo has been plagued by civil conflict and war. The eastern region of Kivu has been one of the hardest hit and has become known as the epicenter of horrific violence against women. And I should warn our listeners that the subject matter of this conversation may be very difficult and even inappropriate for some listeners. Human Rights Watch estimates that some 200,000 women and girls have been raped in Congo since 1998. Both rebel fighters and government soldiers have been known to use rape as a cheap weapon of war to destroy the family and spread disease. The agony of the experience has left thousands of Congolese women and girls frightened and socially stigmatized. One woman has fought back not with a gun, but with a microphone. Shushu Namagabe, a radio journalist, has traveled through the most dangerous places in Congo to talk to rape survivors and try to give them a voice through her radio program.
La République démocratique du Congo a connu des guerres pendant des décennies, et le viol a été utilisé comme arme de guerre afin de...
Shushu is one of this year's Knight International Journalism Award recipients for her work in this area, and she joins us now in our studios in Washington. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you to Michelle.
Is it hard to get people to talk to you about these terrible things that have happened to them?
At the beginning, it was hard, yes. And even to us, we had to prepare ourselves how to meet with victims, how to behave in front of them, what attitude to have so they can talk freely to us. So we had first to prepare ourselves, to train ourselves how to meet with victims. And for them, it was the first step to heal their internal wounds, because they had someone to whom they could talk, to whom they could explain what happened to them. And to others who were still hiding, they came to us. They said, we thought that we were the only to have such problem. But after listening to other testimonies, we can talk also.
I would like to play a short clip of an interview that you conducted with a very young girl who has been raped. It is in her local language. I'm going to ask you to help us with the translation. I'm just going to play it, and here it is.
I'm 13 years old. My village is Kalonge. They took my mother and hanged her on a tree and started raping her. She doesn't know how many raped her. Yeah.
How old was this young girl when you met her?
She was 14 years old.
How do you understand how human beings can do this to each other?
I've never understood why it's such atrocities. Before, I thought that to rape women, it's for sexual pleasure, of military, of rebels. That was my thinking. But when I heard about atrocities which are following the rape in Democratic Republic of Congo, for me, I can't imagine why they are doing that. Because, you know, it's really a way to destroy all the community by using the women's body.
But it's torture. I mean, it's just torture, and it just seems...
Torture, and they don't like to kill them, you know. No. It means they use that atrocities on the women body, but not to kill them, to let them suffering with that all their life. Because, you know, victims are rejected by their families, by all the community. Somewhere is to sensitize the community to accept them and to show the problem that it's not a problem of women, but it's the problem of all the community. And we have, everybody have to do something to help to end it or to help victims.
Why do you think women are still stigmatized who have been treated in such a despicable way? Do people feel it's their fault that they did something to bring this onto themselves?
You know, it's a shame to see that your mother, your sister, your children was being raped. And for the family, it's a shame. It's really a shame. That's why they reject them. They can't live with her when she was being raped. She lose her dignity. She lose all the consideration that she had in the community. Mm-hmm. And there is no way to get it again. That is why we make many sensitization on the community to accept that, to show that it's a big problem of all the community. It's not a problem of women.
Do you feel that you're making any progress?
Yes, we have already made many progress because there are NGOs now which are doing reintegrations. It means the victim has got medical assistance, psychological assistance. Sometimes it doesn't work. They are fleeing again. They are running away from their village. So it's really hard for victims to reintegrate their community.
Is there anything that the people listening to our conversation can do to help you?
Many things. My first thing that I ask to everyone to get involved in the fighting against rape and sexual violences. And that's why we say to talk about it is to act. It means everywhere you are, you can talk about the problem of Congolese women. And it will be a way to make pressure, to make pressure to government, to make pressure to those who have got power to stop it.
Shushu Namigabe is the president and founder of AFEM, that's the South Kivu Association of Women Journalists. She's one of the recipients of the 2009 Knight International Journalism Award for her work bringing attention to the survivors of the rape epidemic in Congo. And she was kind enough to join us here in our studios in Washington. Shushu, thank you so much for speaking with us, and thank you for your very important work.
Thank you very much, Michelle, to invite me, and thank you for all the listeners.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, my commentary, a few more thoughts about the shooting at Fort Hood. But first, for many Americans, Italian cooking still consists of little more than spaghetti and meatballs drowning in a pool of red sauce, or maybe fettuccine Alfredo if you want to get fancy. But our next guests, Gabriele Corcos and Debbie Mazar, shudder at the thought of these dishes. True Italian cooking, they say, the kind your grandma would make, if your grandma was from Italy, does not include any of these meals. In fact, they don't exist in Italy. So Corcos, an Italian music producer from Florence, and Mazar, an actress from Queens, New York, have created an online cooking show called Under the Tuscan Gun. Let's listen to them making minestrone.
My grandma's secret, a couple of pieces of crust of Parmigiano Reggiano. I don't even rinse them. I just toss them in to give the flavor.
So I'm chopping up some vegetables so that they cook down. Add your olive oil. Use quite a lot on the bottom because it's a lot of vegetables here.
It's about 5 tablespoons, I would say.
It's about 5 tablespoons. Do you want me to repeat after you?
And the couple joins us now from our studios in Culver City, California. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having us.
So why is it called Under the Tuscan Gun? Is there conflict of that level in the kitchen? Or, Debbie, does this refer to your earlier role in Goodfellas, which I think many people will remember?
Well, actually, it was one of those moments where I was trying to think of a name for our show, and the gun represents my mother-in-law and my husband saying, cook the way that we cook for, you know, your children. And I've been forced and thrown into having to try to have somewhat of a Tuscan life, and I didn't really know what that was, so it became the Tuscan Gun, and it's really about me.
Did you know? Well, of course it is. But did you know how to cook? Forgive me, I'm not trying to dog you, but did you know how to cook before you met Gabriele?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, I grew up in New York. I've been, you know, in and out of kitchens since a very, you know, young kid. My grandmother basically raised me because my mother had me at 15 and became a hippie. So she was trying to make sukiyaki at the age of 17, which I would give to the dog who wouldn't even eat it, you know, and she was, you know, getting inventive. And I was, you know, I had a Puerto Rican neighbor, a Jamaican neighbor, Irish neighbors. And so I was subjected to, you know, multicultural food from an early age. And I started traveling early. And matter of fact, I've been to Italy many times before I met my husband, which he can't even imagine that I could possibly know anything about Italian food. But, you know, Italian food's really basic. And there's so many different variations on it that what my husband did is he broke it down for me.
But why were they dogging you about your food such that your show is called Under the Gun? Is it that you just, they didn't think you had it quite right?
I think that my interpretation of Italian was a lot more Southern than what my husband cooks. You know, I grew up in Queens and in Brooklyn, and we really, it's more of Southern. It's Naples and Sicily. It's heavier. It's overspiced. And like most Americans, I thought spaghetti and meatballs was genius.
I know. I was devastated to learn that doesn't really exist in Italy.
Well, I know.
I think we should cook that.
Gabriele?
I still believe that you really should eat what makes you feel happy. Comfort food is not necessarily a derogatory term. I make the food that I grew up with because it's a way that I nourish my family. To me, it's just an act of love. If having spaghetti and meatballs makes you happy and makes you go to bed with a smile, go ahead and do that. Use great ingredients, use fresh produce, and then spend time in the kitchen and make it a place that is very alive in the household.
Yeah, but he's more of a purist.
Yeah.
I'm like, who cares? It's like carbs and protein. Isn't that great? Like, you know, won't we be healthier because the meatballs are accompanying the pasta?
I still like the idea of the meat sauce better than the meatball.
Yeah, really? How did you start cooking for Debbie to woo her?
Oh, yeah.
That's the way that she thinks. I cook. But, you know, obviously, you know, I don't want to be of disgrace to any Italian stereotypes. Yes, I wanted to impress her. She was hot. She was in my apartment. And I need to play my own cards. So that, you know, you know, I had to do that.
And Debbie, just briefly, because men and women never agree on this, so I'm going to bias toward you because you're the girl and so am I. How did you two meet?
I was on a holiday in Italy, and I was at a girlfriend's house. Her name is Katia Lebec. She's a famous classical pianist, and my husband was working with her that summer. And he walked into the room, like around midnight one night, and I thought, who is that?
And sounds he was, so good.
No, but he spoke English, and we both enjoy it. We have the same jazz and Brazilian and Afro-Cuban record collections, and we just had so many things that we loved talking about right off the bat, that when he just gave me a peck on the cheek goodnight, I wasn't sure which side to kiss him on first because they do the both sides. And we ended up smashing lips, and I sort of closed the door and melted down the side of the door. And the next day we had a proper date, and it sort of came out of that. And once we met in like May, we never left each other's side. And now it's 10 years later, and we have 2 daughters, and we are still going strong.
Yep.
And an online cooking show.
And yep. That's right. Cooking show.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're talking about Tuscan cooking specifically with Gabriele Corcos and Debbie Mazar. They are the hosts of an online cooking show, Under the Tuscan Gun. Let's listen to another clip of the program. Here it is.
My husband has been obsessed with making biscotti.
Yeah, I will tell you more about that. I had big problems in finding the right yeast, but we are doing...
Finding the right yeast.
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 What did I say? Yeast.
East. East, not east. That's west.
Oh, married 8 years. It's just, you don't understand.
Shut up. So, yeah. So
are you being nice? I can't tell. Are you like...
Oh, yeah. No, we love to argue.
That's nothing. That's nothing.
You know, we don't agree on some things. I'm very curious, so I question things. And the truth is, the whole thing was born out of my husband. I was on location when I was pregnant with my first kid, and he wrote me a love letter that turned into sort of a mini book, mini cookbook, and it was called The Tuscan Cookbook for the Pregnant Male. And in New York, my book agent at the time, David Vigliano, was like, men do not buy cookbooks. Forget about it. Men are not going to read these cookbooks, which I thought he was wrong because I know so many men that are pushing baby carriages and really into the kitchen, but like that's what he said, publishing thoughts. So one day I said, you know what, let's just film an episode because we sort of loved watching Anthony Bourdain and it was so much fun to watch, and we started sharing it with people, and like people were writing and like, oh my god, I'm a big girl and I've lost 15 pounds, or oh my god, my husband's coming back from Afghanistan from the war and I've got all these new things to cook for him. And the outpour was so incredible from all over the world, and especially with chefs, that, you know, they found it refreshing, and that we were two people that weren't chefs to be able to come into the kitchen and just try to enjoy the process of cooking and feeding ourselves.
You know, I have to ask you, Debbie, since you mentioned, you know, you said one of your fans says, well, I'm a big girl and this makes me, you know, helps me eat more healthy. And you are in this field where size does matter. So how do you do it? How do you manage to eat like a normal person and still maintain, which I think a lot of people consider to be the... very strict appearance standards in your field?
Well, you know, I have always had an issue with the whole weight thing with people in general, because I happen to love how big women look. I mean, it's all a perspective. It's all an opinion. And I think sort of the Rubenesque, voluptuous body is a lot sexier than the bony bag of bones with fake everything. For me, it's like, go ahead and eat. Live your life. I mean, I've just seen so much death, you know, as of late, being in my 40s with people getting sick or whatever, that I just feel like, you know what? You never know with life. Eat, enjoy yourself. Just try to be healthy and, you know, and watch it.
You don't deprive yourself?
Never.
No?
No.
Can I get a second source on this, Gabriele?
Well,
true? Is she telling us the real deal?
Oh, please. We have chocolate every night. I mean, I preach healthy organic food and then healthy preparations and no butter and more olive oil. But
I
have Häagen-Dazs in my freezer. You know, our philosophy is that you really shouldn't deprive yourself of things that make you happy. But because eating is you know, a general rule to stay alive, and you really have to do it every day. You have to be conscious about it. You can indulge yourself. You can be luxurious and have your chocolate or your ice cream or the dessert.
I was kidding, saying that, you know, we think that Italian food is spaghetti and meatballs. We've actually come a long way since then. And I'm sure you remember that wonderful movie, Debbie. I know you remember it, Big Night, where it was about this Italian restaurant in the 50s where these guys were actually trying to present real Italian food and nobody wanted it. They thought, what is this? So, and we've come a long way since then. But do you feel that there's an appreciation now for all the varieties of food that are
Italian? I know
that
it's incredible what happened in the past few years. Like, you know, the whole boom of the food phenomenon on TV and on the web is something that is very recent. It wasn't here when I arrived in 2001. I have users writing me and telling me, thank you so much. You reminded me, you allowed me to cook something that finally tasted like my grandmother, if my grandmother was still alive. Flavors that are in danger of being lost in my family, now I'm able to recreate it. You know, to me, I take it for granted, because the way that I tasted the food in my mouth is the same way that it's always tasted, because I started cooking with my grandmother and with my mother. So the fact that I moved here, it makes it harder to find certain ingredients. So my menu sometimes is affected by the fact that, you know, I grew up in Florence. Florence is 350,000 people.
But that leads me to a question, Debbie. I'm going to ask you this because you are a working mom. Gabriele, you work too. But I'm just saying, a lot of women listen to this and they think, oh, great, something else I can feel inadequate about. I can come home and make an Italian meal from scratch. Great. Thanks.
Yeah. I have to say, I credit my husband with thinking ahead, which I don't. He makes things where we freeze stuff, fresh ragu, fresh stuff. We put it in the freezer so that, like, you know, on any given day where we're exhausted and we can't get to the store, we pull something out of the freezer and boom, it's fresh and it's fabulous. Or chicken dogs, you know, fresh steamed broccoli and some kind of carb.
Well, there's always that emergency meal, yeah. Or, you know, you need to keep the kids. The kids are hungry. It's too early for your dinner. You still have to work and you whip something
out.
Yeah,
we're not like, you know, perfect by any means.
Something that to me is very important is that I sometimes I get overwhelmed when I open a book of recipes when I want to try new stuff. What I'm trying, you know, to make our users understand is that very much often is the way that your kitchen works, the way that your fridge is alive, that helps you achieve in the kitchen what you want to do. It's not just about the recipe. It's about being able to do the good, you know, the right groceries, having a fridge that is alive and not stocked with stuff that just sits there.
But finally, we're going to end on this note. There are a lot of people on a tight budget right now.
Yes.
I'm sure, you know, you're aware of this, whatever your circumstances, there are a lot of people who really have to watch every penny.
Oh, absolutely.
And do you have some guidance for people who want to eat healthy, but, you know, they can't spring for these expensive ingredients and it just isn't in the cards right now? What do you
say? That's the thing. What we like about our cooking show is that our cooking show from the very beginning was not about spending money on the best olive oil or on the Quasette cooking gear or whatever. It was always about buying a couple of fresh things, using whatever you have. We've had the most incredible meals cooked for us on a electric 4-burner grill in Italy that the woman turned out a feast. And so, you know, you don't need to spend money to eat fresh. In fact, in all 40 episodes that are currently available to everybody, there's almost nothing there that's very expensive.
Yeah, there's probably one fish recipe that exceeded the $40. But for the rest, we are a family that lives on a regular budget.
We're on a budget, and nobody has money right now. And eating is very important, but it doesn't need to be expensive and it doesn't need to be fancy. And as long as it's fresh and simple, the simpler it is, the more fancy it actually comes out tasting.
Okay, Gabrielle, I'm going to give you the last question since you are the planner, as Debbie's told us. What's for dinner tonight?
Oh, we haven't discussed. We went through the leftovers last night. That was we are great advocates of leftovers. What are we going to do tonight? Maybe a pork roast. Kids are missing that. They asked for it. Maybe some rice with a sofrito. We'll think about it. I wanted to bake some cookies.
I'm big on making salads.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll wait. I'll look for my invitation in the mail.
Oh, please.
Debbie Mazar and Gabriele Corcos are the hosts of Under the Tuscan Gun. It's an online cooking show, and they joined us from our studios in Culver City, California. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Finally, I have a few more thoughts about the tragedy at Fort Hood. In my commentary last week, I talked about the feelings of shame such an event evokes when one's own group is implicated, particularly if one belongs to a minority group that is often tagged with society's ills. I was very moved by the response. Many of you, from a variety of backgrounds, wrote to tell me of your own experience of being painted with the group brush of dysfunction. But of course, we also had the usual side serving of what I call racism light. One person wrote in to say she thought it was just fine that I was asked, in the wake of a scandal by a black colleague at the newspaper where I once worked, to provide proof of my college degree when I tried to rent an apartment when a white roommate of mine, who worked at the same place, was not. Really? Try this. Why aren't we demanding that all white men who want to work in the financial sector prove in advance they aren't dishonest or reckless with other people's money? It was mainly white men who were in charge of our financial institutions and made the decisions that led to the current economic meltdown, wasn't it? So it's their fault, right? Sound ridiculous to you? Over the top? Probably illegal. But tell me then why there's always somebody around to try to justify why it's okay to cast suspicion on black and brown people or members of religious minorities as a group because of the actions of one or even a few. Can I just tell you, there are many questions raised by the story of Army Major Nidal Hassan. A number of those questions have to do, as Tom Ricks, the prize-winning writer on military affairs, told us last week, with the way bureaucracies function. Major Hassan, the Army psychiatrist accused in the Fort Hood shooting, had been expensively trained by the Army in a much-needed specialty, and he was an officer, a member of the club. So you can see why the Army was reluctant to let him go, even though he was sending all kinds of signals about his growing mental instability. You can understand it. Why are all these geniuses and all these financial institutions so reluctant to let go of those huge profits they were making from poorly underwritten mortgages and other speculative investments? The incentives were all in one direction. But to the degree that Major Hassan's story does speak to ethnicity and religion and the experience of being a minority, the answer, it seems to me, is more diversity, not less. You have to wonder what would have been the reaction to the Major's now infamous PowerPoint presentation if there had been several other Muslims in the room. The Major's extremist and fundamentalist description of Islam in that presentation would likely have been challenged. According to one report, there was one other Muslim doctor present. But did he or she feel able to challenge him? Was he or she equal in rank and stature? I see this in my own field, where on most days, African Americans are conspicuously absent from the most prestigious confabs about politics or policy, or now, because it's Obama time, there might be one. As for Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, you could be forgiven if you did not know there were any people of these backgrounds who have expertise in national politics and policy, although there are many. And thus the views of the one or two who manage to slip through the door become inordinately important. Too important. They become the unelected spokespersons for their group, whether it's a job they've applied for or not, whether it's a job they are qualified for or not. The only answer is more diversity, not less, so individuals can truly be judged by the quality of their work, not the color of their skin or the origin of their last name or the name of the god they worship. That way, the range of opinions and attitudes and aptitudes within each group can speak for itself. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.